Good morning. We'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session for the Mesa City Council for Thursday. What is today anyway? March 1st, post-leap year day. February 30th?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Wesley. Oh, is Richens? You know what? You know what impresses me most is that I said thank you, Mr. Wesley. He just sat there and took it. He took the bullet.
He threw
in front of it. Now Richens, I think, was on the floor by the time I said that. He was hiding, but Wesley took it like a man. Oh, okay. Is Councilmember Higgins? Oh, okay. She was going to call in, but is she here?
I heard she'd be calling in this morning. She won't be present.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins, you calling in? We'll wait for her to call in. So she's not here unless she calls in. The first item on the agenda is to review the agenda for next Monday's regular city council meeting. We'll begin on page 2. We haven't even started. The staff's already sitting up.
Very efficient.
Okay.
Which one?
Good morning. I just wanted to point out item 3D on ARCO. They had a violation of the liquor board back in 2006 for selling to a minor, but everything's been clean since then, and they've paid all their fines and everything's good. But I just wanted to point that out.
So staff recommends go ahead with the recommendation of approval?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Anything else on page 2, items 3A through 3D? Page 3, 3E through 4C. Councilmember Richens?
Are we labeling districts with the new districts or the old districts when we're identifying location?
Are we a new district or an old district?
I will.
Main Street is not in my district anymore, so that's
okay. We need to probably share those maps with the staff. We can get familiar with the new alignments. We can start doing that.
You know, you change a map and Dave, you just forget them all that quickly, huh? I'll tell you.
Well, on 4A through 4C, is citywide still citywide, or do we have a new citywide?
Page 4, items 4. Councilmember Finter.
4B. I'd like 4B? To pull it. Yeah, pull it 4 off Bravo. The consent agenda. Have lots of questions, and I can work those out before our next study session if possible, but concerned.
Can we just bid that out?
Yeah.
I mean, last time we had a lot of Arizona companies bid on it, and we're buying
Didn't we have this discussion before last time this
Yes,
before?
We did, and that's what we're
And we talked on. About there was something about the San Diego company. I remember having this discussion.
Well, there's a
this
Chandler,
seemed like it was like last
through a
month.
Chandler contract, and yeah,
like, Mr. Mayor, council members, it's actually
and a
not
plethora pretty, of yeah. officials is approaching the podium.
We're not just piggybacking on the Chandler contract. We participated. We were a partner with Chandler when this went out. So our quantities. And our items were part of their estimated quantities when the contract went out. So it wasn't just a piggyback cooperative.
So a couple questions.
Sure.
So how many Arizona companies put in for this then?
I'd have to go back through my notes from last year.
That would be an important part to have. And just kind of work through some detail. I don't want to do it in public.
But. We can take care of that.
Yeah, if you could come back and then Monday, because I know we had this discussion.
We did.
I vaguely remember it.
Yes.
And,
we
did. About how this, for some reason, the San Diego company does something different. They dip their tips in lead or whatever it is. I don't know what the deal was, but I remember there was something. So if you'd come back and.
Shoot. We'll do that.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Anything else on that page? Items 4D through 5B. Items 5C through 6C. C 6D through 8. Oh,
sorry,
Councilmember Richards.
I was trying to find my item. Item 5D, the fees and charges for the Parks and Recreation Department.
5D, yes.
There's only one that I kind of have a little heartburn with. And there's an additional charge for, we give a family pass for the swim, which my children absolutely love. But this year we're adding additional charges for people, for families that have more than six members. And we have a lot of large families in District 1. And the problem has been that some people had been putting non-family members on their family passes, and it was causing, and so that, I mean, that's just not right. So I think there's a way, there's got to be a way, maybe we have to have either positive ID or like birth certificates or any of those kind of things that we can require to, instead of doing additional charges just because you have a large family. So it's like penalizing somebody because they have a lot of kids. Is there a way that we can at least, you know, maybe change our policies and procedures to have them?
What is the problem here? Is the problem we have large families, or the problem we have people with small families who are dragging? Yeah,
they're putting multiple.
Those seem to be two different problems. So right. What are we trying to stop here?
Right.
If we're trying to stop large families, I don't see how that's a huge issue.
We're trying to make family passes be for one family.
So why don't we just say
two
that?
Families. That's what we do, but apparently people have still been committing some kind of family pass fraud, which I'm sure the police are all over.
Mayor, Council, the issue is, it really, what it should technically be called is a household pass. And what people are doing is they're bringing, saying multiple people live within those households. So it could be people that don't have IDs. So you're talking about 7, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds that don't have IDs. So we're taking, you know, the word of mouth. But there's, if you look at our registration system, that's part of our system, a lack of record keeping within our current technology that we have, is that it doesn't allow us to capture those people, take pictures within that system. That would help us, and that's something we're looking at.
How about we do this? How about we say the family pass is a household pass up to so many people, then over that you have to be in the same blood family, and if you want that, you can come in and prove that, and then you can get it. Wouldn't that accomplish
I just don't want to penalize a family that has five kids. And I know I can rattle off a dozen of them in Mesa that like to buy the family pass. And so, you know, it's just seemed kind of counterintuitive to what we were trying to accomplish. We want people to use our pools.
Six. Yes. Right now, Mayor, Council, it's a maximum of six members per household. And then each additional member, as I don't have it right here with me, but I believe it's $20 an individual. And our passes are significantly reduced anyways. So you're talking...
I mean,
$20 for a full season is
we want people to use our pools. We want lots of people to come and have a great time. I mean, that's the whole point. And it just seemed kind of counterintuitive what we're trying to provide for our pools.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'm just thinking off the cuff. But if you say that the problem is we have people who are piggybacking and who are creating households that are bypassing that, cap it at six unless you can come in with the birth certificates and show you have six kids, and then if they're part of the same family, you come to the family pass. I don't know. Chew on it a little bit. If the purpose is to keep, because it seems like you don't want to punish big families. You want to keep people from abuse, combining things to get a good deal and being a little bit, you know, gerrymandering the system.
Yeah.
Correct.
Well, let's just say, here, you get six, and we won't ask, and then over that, you come in with your six kids, and you have eight, and you... And we just offended Councilmember Higgins. I'm sorry about that. You still right there, Dina? Nope, she's not.
So we'll go back, amend the information that's in your reports now, pull that one, the additional fee out, and then we'll rewrite the policy.
Let's work that one over a little bit. Thank you.
Does that sound okay, Councilman Richards?
That'd be wonderful.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, anything else on that page? 6D through 8A. And 9A and 9B. Okay. I think Councilmember Higgins joined us for a
brief moment.
The next item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed use of the Washington Activity Center by EduPrize Charter Schools. One thing of note, and I know we got some people who are interested in this issue. This in the study session, we don't normally take citizen input on specific items. This is an item for us to receive input from the staff, and so we don't normally have that. You'll have it, obviously have a chance anytime. If you want to speak during the items for citizens present, we're more than happy to do that. Or on Monday when we actually act on it, you'll have plenty of opportunity to weigh in. So just so you understand the process here.
Mayor, Council, again, good morning. With me today is Dr. Lynn Robershot and Dr. Barbara Duncan with EduPrize. Let's give you a brief history on where we're at regarding the Washington Activity Center and how we got to this proposed partnership. Again, in 2008, funding for the Washington Activity Center was shifted from the general fund to CDBG funding. As you all are familiar, that those dollars continue to decline over the years from the federal government and what they're providing the city. In 2011, the City Council did approve $200,000 in CDBG funding for this fiscal year's operations, but at that point, you did reiterate to myself and my staff that if a community partner was not able to be identified for the operation of that facility, we would have to look at alternatives, including closing of the center. Over the last several years, discussions with potential partners have taken place, but due to different fee-for-service models or other considerations, a suitable partner could not be identified until recently. In early 2011, the West Mesa CDC connected myself and Dr. Robershot and Dr. Duncan. We began discussing the potentials of what this partnership could look like for the community and where it would look at, what it could look like. And I believe most of you have had an opportunity to meet or talk directly to either Dr. Duncan or Dr. Robershot directly about EduPrize, but we're talking about an excellent charter school. Was founded in 1995, was the first charter school to receive A-plus certification, and really have a real holistic approach to learning and addressing the whole child and what that through hands-on means, experiential learning, and helping those kids grow their educational skills. EduPrize has shown a genuine interest in operating a charter school and providing community programs, specifically serving the Washington Park neighborhood. Dr. Robershot got her start in education in that community and is looking as this is an opportunity to come back to her roots and give back. We first made a presentation to the community on June 2nd, 2011 that explained the highlights of the school and the benefits and why they were interested in looking at and locating in this neighborhood and what that would mean in terms of the programming that would be provided, the additional benefits with the school coming in, etc. And on September 23rd, EduPrize sponsored a movie night, presented information about the school and their interest in the community. And then again on January 25th, we did present this proposal to the Community and Cultural Development Committee. There was unanimous support to bring that before the full council. There are a couple of questions out of the committee that I did want to address that are also in the staff report I provided. But one of the questions focused on the exterior aesthetics of the facility that I believe Vice Mayor brought up. And EduPrize will coordinate with the city and use the students' live learning labs to address those, whether it be art projects through different murals or space set aside for community gardens and plantings. That's something that they, as part of their curriculum, that they like to embrace and get the students involved in that. In addition, staff was asked to look at the requirements for soliciting proposals for operation of this facility. We did work with City Attorney's Office and Purchasing to go through that process and solicited additional proposals if they were out there by advertisement on the city's purchasing website as well as advertisement in the Arizona Republic from February 4th, 2011 through February 15th. No additional proposals or comments were received regarding this facility. And then finally, staff was asked to look at any available financial subsidies available from the state that could be provided to those parents that don't wish to participate in this program and if they were available. And the Department of Economic Security does have child care benefits available at certain facilities, and that information and how to apply for those benefits along with other resources within the community for community gathering rooms when school's in session and other space may need to be available, etc. We've been working on preparing that jointly so that can be distributed to the community. Through this partnership, the city's responsibilities will be to maintain the exterior of the building. We'll remain the property holder of the real property, so we'll be responsible for the foundations, walls, roofs, any of the perimeter fencing or walls, the heating and cooling units, any of the utility infrastructure, main water pipes, delivery systems, etc. And EduPrize is agreeing to take on 100% of all the utilities and normal repairs and maintenance of the buildings in those grounds immediately adjacent to the facility for the provision of operating a charter school during the day, and then return for operating the school after the school hours, are roughly 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the afternoon till the early evening. They'll provide after school programming, extended day programming, summer programming, adult community programs, and also work with different groups on a space available basis to provide programs for Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, etc. We believe that this really is a win-win for the community. Addresses council's request to reduce the funding that's coming from CDBG and that isn't available in the general fund. Again, it gives the city the opportunity to focus back on regional recreation providing as opposed to neighborhood-based recreation providing. And we believe even with EduPrize coming in, that's an enhancement to the programs that are already being offered there and that will continue. The charter school coming in is just one more benefit to the community to help this neighborhood grow.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Councilmember Finter.
Well, just an observation. I think this is a great model we ought to look at in other areas. I know with Broadway Rec Center, we have individual, you know, a different group that runs it, but it's a citizen-owned asset. And I hope we look at this opportunity, if this goes well, to look at other areas and see where. I'm sure there's numerous examples, but I think it's part of the mayor's vision and this council that we rethink the way services are provided and look at outside the box, different models. And I think this would be, I think this indicates it's a great move in the right direction. So,
okay, Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. I also agree that this is a good project. I serve on the West Mesa CDC board along with Councilmember Richens, and I want to applaud the CDC and Councilmember Glover for their leadership efforts in working with the neighborhood and working and to commend our staff for finding an innovative way to advance the cause of education in the community in a way that I think will significantly benefit the residents. And so I think if you recall, when some of us came into office in June 2008, the center was going to close, and we turned to CDBG funds on a short-term solution, but looking for a longer-term promise for the center and the neighborhood. And I think this is a very good opportunity for the community. So I want to commend everybody who's worked very hard on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilmember. Any other comments, questions? Vice Mayor.
Mayor, to follow up on the comments I had earlier in the prior meeting, we're going to see some fairly significant savings by partnering with EduPrize, and I would like the council to consider taking just a small portion of those on a one-time basis to look at what other kind of improvements that we can make to the building to help. There's a lot going on in Escobedo. In the Washington area to really create new buildings and a new look and upgrade the infrastructure there. And I think it's an opportunity to just take a small portion at one time, add some architectural features, and that in conjunction with what's going on with the schools suggesting, we could really make that a really nice building. Thanks.
Thank you. Councilman Richens.
At 3 o'clock. We'll be, or 3:30, I think, we'll be reviewing CDBG recommendations, so we can have that discussion today.
If there's money there.
If there's money there, if we can find it. Okay.
There's money on that CDBG, but yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. That was easy.
Thank you.
Now, completely reversing what I said previously, we still don't normally take No, go ahead. You can leave. We normally don't take citizen input during study sessions, but since this is the only real action, or not even an action item, this is the only item on the agenda other than a staff report. If Sarah Hinos, come on up. If you want to say a couple words, and Bruce Nelson after that, if you want to say a couple words on this.
Well, good morning, council members. Thank you for allowing us to come and to speak. We appreciate you stepping out of your usual boundaries for how you do things. Yeah. I just wanted to speak in support of EduPrize. They have a really great option for other than closing the center. We realize that the city has some very tight budget restrictions, obviously, and there are some things that need to get cut sometimes. We appreciate you guys having been able to fund the center for longer, as you have, and now that it needs to be taken over by someone else, it seems that EduPrize is the best option for that. We appreciate how they've worked so well with the neighborhood and gotten input on things that would be helpful to the neighborhood. Essentially, the function that the center provides right now, I'm an instructor there and have lived in the neighborhood for quite a while, is after-school programs. It's a place for the neighborhood kids and the parents as well to be able to come and hang out and learn different things. EduPrize would be keeping the afternoon sessions going for the kids. So the center would function the same way in the afternoons as it currently does, but then it would have the additional function of being a school in the morning. So we just appreciate the way Drs. Duncan and Robershot have been really good about communicating with the neighborhood and making sure that that it's really a neighborhood effort and not just an outside organization. They've really wanted to be very involved. So
thank you, Sarah.
That's all.
Appreciate it. And Bruce Nelson.
Good morning, everyone. Mayor, Vice Mayor, all the good stuff. I'm not
so
good.
You and I are at the good stuff.
I'm not all there. I just want to say, last time I saw the mayor, where they're doing the presentation of the history, and he came over to me and he said, "I went to school with you," and I was like, I can't remember.
You're not the only one that's tried to forget.
So I went and I looked at our yearbook and I said, "Oh, I remember the guy who played basketball, the really short thing," you know. I was like, "Yeah, I remember we played ball." So it came back to me right away.
Okay.
It came back to me. It was in the 70s when they were wearing it.
And here I thought it was the sweetness of the jump shot.
Darn it. So, yes, I just want to say, you know, thank you for looking at this. It was originally a school, and I sent you guys an email. You probably didn't get to read it. But it was a Booker T. Washington school, a segregated school. It served its purpose well, and now it's like come full circle. It's come back to be a school in a more positive way this time, as opposed to. So I think that's great. I hope you guys get over with them. And they've really agreed to really do a continue the services that we want. And we beat them up pretty bad at those meetings. Boy, really blasted them. And the movie night was great. I think they're going to have another movie night showing one of my movies, right? Yeah. But thank you all so much. I do appreciate it. And hopefully we can move forward.
Now, next movie night, maybe we can show some basketball highlights. We can show the basketball highlight from my career.
Before he steps away, it's to note his movie that he just made. It chronicles the history of Washington Park Escobedo neighborhood, and I think you just had a premiere not long ago.
We did a screening.
The screening.
We're going to finish it up in the next couple of weeks.
Good. Very good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, we had a late entry, Maria. If you want to come up and say a couple words. Maria Mancinas, go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Maria Mancinas, and I live in Washington Escobedo community, 542 North Lewis, for the past 30 years. And I am here to report that the neighbors of Washington Escobedo are currently working on their quality of life plan. Two Saturdays ago, the community got together under the facilitation of West Mesa CDC, and the community created and voted on the goals and strategies for parks and recreation as well as code compliance. And the goal of the neighbors is to maintain Washington Activity Center open as a recreation center for the neighbors and the community at large, and also to continue utilizing the services of Escobedo Park and Escobedo and Washington Park as well. So I am here to oppose the establishment of a charter school at Washington Activity Center and further to continue this facility for the service and recreation of the neighbors of Washington Escobedo. I'm very confident that as we conclude our quality of life plan at the end of May of 2012, we will be able to seek and secure funding for Washington Activity Center. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maria. I guess I would like to say one thing in response to that. I think this council was very, very clear in 2008 that when there was no money, and actually this center was closed. I remember, I think that was either our first or second meeting when the council decided to dip into CDBG funds to keep the center open for, at that time, which was a one-year reprise. Reprise, reprieve, I guess is the right word. And then we reprised it the next year. I think we've been very, very upfront with the residents of the Washington Park area that they were living on borrowed time. Many other rec centers in this city were closed. The Washington, because we recognize the unique nature of the history of the neighborhood, the unique nature of the facility, we appreciated that as a council, and we recognized that, and we kept it open. That was 4 years ago. And, frankly, I think that the neighborhood and the city has explored several different options, I think, as Mr. Hirschberg talked about, and he wasn't even around for the first round of those. There has been ample time to look at a place. This year, with the actions in Congress, we were very, very upfront in saying we think if CDBG goes the way it goes, there will not be money. And I think the only thing that has helped us to dodge the bullet was the change in the allocation formulas, because CDBG was actually cut nationwide by 12%, which for us would have been a huge, huge hit. We sort of made up some of that difference because of the change in allocations because of the census, because CDBG, and one of the primary factors in allocation is population and proportionate population. But the fact of the matter is that this is a time where time and time again we've decided to move on with the very, very specific, I don't want to say warning, but the reality is that, listen, we don't have the money to continue this. I was very impressed with what EdgePrice has done. I think that it's a great program because it makes very good use of that facility, which is a good thing. We don't want an empty facility. But I think the great thing that EdgePrice brings is we get a twofer. And the one thing is we get to maintain programs that are essential to that area. Are they going to be exactly the same programs? No, they're not. But they still are maintained. The hours are a little bit different, some of them because they need to be. But the one thing we have is we have an award-winning, very well-recognized educational institution that is bringing quality education into the middle of that neighborhood and offers the residents of that neighborhood a choice. And that's the important thing, is they have a choice. They don't have to go to this school. They don't have to make use. But I think it's great that we've enhanced the quality of life in that neighborhood by partnering with someone who can offer that enhancement, which is, and this, unless I'm missing something, how I read it is now the residents have a choice. And EdgePrice just is not a caretaker organization, is a great thing. They offer something that's an improvement, an enhancement, and that offers, I believe, a real opportunity for the neighborhood. So I'm very happy with the proposal on board. And once again, I think we've gone through many, many gyrations of proposals. I don't think I could have guessed it would end up any better than to offer the type of partnering and the partners that we've had in this. Okay, all right. Okay, thank you. Mr. Butler, I think you're up. Legislative update. And we're going to discuss, I'm sorry. little slip there.
That was the proper word choice, Mayor.
Somebody have a title.
2012 State Legislative Update.
Thank you, sir. Mayor, members of council. That favorite time of year, we get to update you on all of the fun that is occurring down on West Washington and the ways that the legislature has gotten involved in the way we do business. So just briefly, again, about 1,400 bills have been introduced this session, of nearly 200 that have an impact in some manner on the city of Mesa. Right now, as you've probably read in the paper, the legislature and the governor are not seeing eye to eye on the state budget situation. They're in impasse in negotiations, and really one of the major components of that are different revenue numbers and projections coming from their respective budget offices. The governor is seeing more robust growth in state revenue this year, and would like to allocate some of the surplus that they're that they expect in the governor's budget to go to some one-time spending in education and some to buy back the state capitol buildings and a few other things that she's proposed. The legislature doesn't agree that the revenue is going to come in at the clip that the governor's office is projecting, and they're projecting about a $300 million difference in that, and they would like to maintain basically a flat budget from the previous year with no additional spending, and would roll over any surpluses into a rainy day fund and not do any additional one-time spending. So right now they're doing the customary standoff between the legislature and the governor, and we're not really certain when we'll see some movement on the budget.
Scott, do you think that it seems like that standoff is really related to non-budget related items, like personnel rules and stuff like that. Doesn't this all go into the same pot as part of the jimmying?
Well, it all fits together. Okay. Certainly, the budget projections are a real difference as far as how much money they really think they have to spend, but everything's negotiated along with the budget. Yeah. And
but they're not even talking right now on the budget. Now, my understanding is, I was just watching the news last night, is that the governor has instructed her staff not even to engage in negotiations.
Right. I think there's still some back channel discussions going on, but by
that's
and
just
large,
posturing, though, right?
That's some posturing that we usually see every year at various stages. It's just they've actually started earlier this year, which we appreciate that they have started to move through this stage earlier than they normally do. Both budgets, though, happy to report, have no impact on urban revenue sharing or state collected sales tax. And then,
excuse me, before you move on, can I have a question?
Hello, Councilmember Higgins.
Hi, good morning. The question I have for Scott is, how does the extra 1% sales tax, do they include any of that when they're talking budget, or is that totally a separate item?
Mayor, Councilwoman Higgins, that is included in the revenue projections. The 1 cent sales tax will impact the current budget cycle for FY13, but after that, in FY14, after the sunset of the 1 cent sales tax, that's also a big difference between the two budgets, is depending upon which projection you use, the amount of surplus, if there will be one, or deficit after the expiration of the 1 cent.
And that tax expires May 31st, 2013.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. So the FY14 budget year, if you look at the slide and you see the differences between the surplus amounts and the revenue projection amounts, a lot of that reflects the differing views between the governor's budget office and the legislative budget office.
Well, I'm a little confused there on the legislatives. They show no drop-off in revenue from 13 to 14. So they're assuming that in 1 year, all of a sudden, we pick up nearly $1 billion in revenue?
That is the belief, that the growth the growth estimates are such that even with
that's going to start on June 1st, 2013, and just go from there.
Some of the stimulus/tax cut reform efforts will be fully implemented at that time, and they believe the growth of the economy that will result from the new tax policies that have been implemented over the last several years will help offset the decrease in sales tax revenue, and you'll have a more robust economic.
And that's all going to happen in 1 year. Okay.
Those are the projections.
Perhaps you mentioned it and I missed it. How much of this surplus is related to the increase in sales tax that was approved by voters that expires in a year or two?
The surplus ends up, sales tax increase ends up being around just under $1 billion a year. And so so when you talk about the surplus, I mean, it's all relative to if you see a $300 million surplus. Well, in FY13, the governor's proposing nearly a $600 million surplus. So obviously, a large portion of that could be attributed to the one.
So what the governor's saying, just if we round it off, is that $600 million surplus in 13, which means it's about $1 billion in revenue out of that tax. She's figuring that we're going to save $600 million of the 1%, the temporary sales tax, and spend $400 million. And the next year, she's saying that we're going to drop by $1 billion, but we're going to pick up about $600 million in new revenue. Whereas the legislature predicts that there's no drop-off at all, that you're going to pick up $1 billion in new revenue in fiscal year 14.
Correct.
Okay. That maybe I must not be understanding those projections. That seems really strange.
Who's doing the math down there?
I will say for the last 2 years, it's the governor's budget office has been more accurate than JLBC. It's always the guessing game somewhat between trying to read the crystal ball of what the economy is going to do. But
let's hope they're both wrong, and it's a lot higher than that.
Yeah, the last 2 years, though, which is part of the posturing and the negotiation, the governor said, I've been accurate the last couple of years, so you should use my projections and not your projections. So that's all part of the game that's being played right now. But going back to both proposals, neither impact shared revenue, and both continue at this point two assessments on cities and towns. One is the fee that all cities have to provide based on population for funding the Department of Water Resources. And that's a fee that then we have placed on our water bill to let our residents know of this mandate from the state. There has been a strong desire by the legislature, and not so much by the governor's office, but by the legislature to remove that fee, and it will not at all surprise me before a budget's finalized to see that fee done away with. We had hoped to see it in the initial projection, but the introduction of a budget's just the start of the negotiation, and what we've heard the governor's office has told the legislature, if they can find $6.5 million somewhere else, that she's okay with the fee going away, but she's not proposing the elimination of that fee. The second component, and Miranda will talk about in a little bit more detail, has been the effort of the league and counties and others to really highlight the impact of HERF sweeps on cities and towns and counties across the
HERF.
State. Highway User Revenue Funds, excuse
Pause
me.
Your 50 cents
it'll come. I'll go ahead and put a couple of dollars because I'm sure after
Thank
this
you.
Presentation. Highway User Revenue Funds are collected by the state off of gas tax and other vehicle license tax, other components like that, and are shared with cities and towns, counties, ADOT, and others. But the legislature has consistently, for more than a decade, even during billion-dollar surplus years, continued to sweep these funds and use it for state purposes not associated with streets and highways and roads. And so Miranda can walk through a little bit about what we've experienced and also some of the efforts that the league and others have done to try to draw a line in the sand.
And I think one of the problems we have is that we keep referring to this as HERF, and people don't understand that's the very nice government bureaucratic type name. It's gas tax.
Right.
When people buy a gallon of gas, what is the state? 18 cents.
Mm-hmm.
Is supposed to go into what is a fund that is used to pay for street maintenance and for highways and for things like that. And the legislature has consistently taken that out of streets and highways and used it for very, very suspect uses to help offset general fund deficits. That to me is just unconscionable that you'd take money out of what is really, and I know maybe technically it's not a trust fund, although the way it's set up, the uses are limited by law. The legislature has done that consistently, and it's, I think if everyone really understood what was happening, that they would be a lot more upset than they are. But they constantly refer to it as HERF and things in government, and people just don't understand it. It's gas tax. Mm-hmm. and it's your registration fee and those kind of things that are restricted by law, and they should be restricted by law, because that is sort of like a user fee that the state imposes upon us, and the cities are precluded from collecting any sales tax, any other kind of tax on gas sales. That was the agreement as part of revenue sharing. And these monies were supposed to come back for the cities as part of the state collecting these on behalf of the cities and restricting the cities of what we could collect so that cities would be able to keep streets right. Now, Mesa, thank heavens, has escaped a lot of the really dire consequences because we have a dedicated sales tax. There are other cities, especially smaller cities, that their entire street budget is made up of HERF, highway user funds that come from, that are collected by the state and come back, and they've been devastated by this because now they've had to cut parks and other things to fund street maintenance when they should be able to rely on gas tax to do that. So that's my editorial comment for the day.
And Mayor, before we go through a few numbers, I think it should be noted that finally the bond market's starting to really catch on to that. ADOT, the Arizona Department of Transportation, had its bond rating downgraded because of the uncertainty of the legislative sweeps. And I see Mr. Brady's leaning it. We've also had some impact on our street bonds specifically because of this issue. So
even though we don't rely on HERF for we do, but we have a backup. We've been affected because right. The bond people just lump us all into the same thing because of what the legislature is doing to the how they consider it like a trust fund.
They do.
Because it should be dedicated user fee, which you would think that fellow conservatives like user fees because those who use the the services pay for them, and they're going away from that. So I didn't realize that it had affected.
Of all the refinancings and bonds that we issued in the last while, that was the only one. They got a note from, I think it was S&P, specifically mentioned the actions of the state.
Really?
And how they're treating the Highway User Revenue Fund that had an impact on the rating of those bonds. So it had nothing to do, we could control as a city, but because it was tied to the Highway 24 project and the source of funding, that note was put into the rating, and it took a slight hit because of it.
And 24 is a regional project, which isn't even funded by.
That's right.
By HERF.
It's funded by regional
sales tax.
The rating agencies, as they look at this in New York, they look at just the general atmosphere for how highway funds are treated in the state, and they see the consistent diversion of these funds and the uncertainty around these funds, and it has an impact. But for ADOT, it was a very substantive impact for them to have their entire program downgraded, and so that means
that all these monies they've diverted will probably end up spending anyway, except for instead of keeping those in state, we'll pay Wall Street in higher interest rates.
Correct.
That's great financial management.
Yeah. Why don't we just briefly, Miranda, if you'd like to walk.
He wants to move on before I do any more damage. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'll be brief since we've talked quite a bit about these HERF funds, but Mayor, you are correct. This is a continuous sweep by the legislature. I just wanted to highlight a couple numbers. Over the past 5 years, local government has paid upwards of $178 million to fund state departments, particularly the Motor Vehicle Division and the Department of Public Safety. In fiscal year 12, you'll note that cities and counties will contribute more to DPS than the state will. And perhaps what's even more offensive is that is if this trend continues by fiscal year 15, local government will pay 97% of the funding for DPS.
If we could manage it, we can start making decisions. Once you own it, can't you?
We can control our own streets.
The impact to the city of Mesa for the last 5 years has been about $3.7 million. Now, these are funds that could have and should have been used to pay for street projects and other transportation infrastructure in our community. Representative Vic Williams, who is the chair of the House Transportation Committee, is a friend of ours on this issue and a proponent to stop these HERF sweeps.
He's introduced two different measures and, in fact, is holding a House Transportation Hearing Committee this morning at 9 to talk about this issue.
All right, moving on from HERF. I don't know if this is better to move or worse to move on from that issue, but tax reform has been an issue that's had a lot of interest at the legislature, more procedural reforms than the actual rates, even though you certainly hear a lot of talk at the legislature annually about rates. But one bill, HB 2123 by Steve Cord of Mesa, would form a panel to look at the way the state collects its transaction privilege taxes, both at the state and the local level. And he structured the bill so that there would be city representatives included with the state and in counties and other taxing jurisdictions on this. The idea is what can we continue to do to make the collection and distribution of transaction privilege tax easier on both those of us who receive that as government entities and those paying the taxes. And that's starting to be evident in other bills. I'll just mention 2466, which requires cities to adopt an online portal for folks who are collecting TPT in the community businesses to go on and pay that on an online portal.
Collecting what?
TPT.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Sales tax.
Yes, sales tax. Excuse me.
Transaction privilege tax. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I actually did mention it, Mayor, earlier. I did. I did spell it.
You put it in the context so people can go ahead.
Great. So I just didn't know if I got 50 cents back then or not. But once sales tax collection, how it's paid, because if you do operate a business in multiple jurisdictions, Phoenix has a different method than we do, and Scottsdale has a different method than Tempe, and so it has been a system that even the league understands has a lot of complexity to it for taxpayers, and the league has already begun this effort without a bill, which hopefully will not go forward because of the understanding by the House and Senate leadership that the league is already looking at options to look at an online vendor who could collect our who could do sales tax collection online. Also, a bill that won't have a measurable impact on Mesa is an effort to basically do away with the dual assessment valuations that we have on property tax. Right now, primary property tax is assessed on a certain valuation of your home. Secondary property tax is assessed on another valuation of your home. There's been an effort for several years now that may ultimately pass this year, led by the Arizona Tax Research Association, that would basically do away with that dual effort and bring Arizona in line with many states that have one assessed valuation by which primary and secondary property tax are assessed. We've had our folks look at this closely, and for most cities and towns, this will not have a major impact. And for Mesa, since we've been very fiscally conservative with our bonding capacity and our debt limits, it will not have an impact as we're projecting it if this bill were to pass. Probably the most onerous bills at the legislature, though, and each of these would probably take an hour to explain if I can even fully understand them, and that's part of the problem, are the quote-unquote regulatory reform bills. That's one of the buzzwords you're hearing everywhere, both in Washington and Phoenix, and everywhere we look is regulatory reform. But as often the case, the devil's in the detail. And unfortunately, several of these bills that I'll mention briefly are very onerous to cities and towns, and we're already starting to see some organizations, even some business organizations, come out against these bills because they believe it will make the burden even more onerous on business to do to interact with the city. The first of which I'll mention is House Bill 2815. The Goldwater Institute has a concept added in this bill that would basically say that.
Why don't we just start numbering the bills? Goldwater 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Wouldn't it be a lot easier to track them?
We could do
a
whole section on Goldwater bills.
Between ALEC and Goldwater, we could probably handle probably about 95% of the bills in the legislature that way.
I don't disagree, Mayor.
ALEC, Goldwater, and NRA. Yeah. We could handle them all.
The House Bill 2815. What the concept is that if you have suffered, quote-unquote, excessive regulation at the hands of a local jurisdiction, you're entitled to a tax credit. So natural question becomes, who defines what's excessive regulation? Well, funny you should ask. The governor's regulatory review panel, who has no idea how we conduct business at the legislature, is the at the local level, is the entity that has been selected in this bill to be the arbiter of whether something is excessive regulation. But I'm certain that my definition is different than Councilmember Kavanaugh's definition, who's different than the mayor's definition. And so what this really is, it's a field day for litigation against cities and towns, that we would be sued for basically anyone who feels that they haven't, that they've been excessively regulated by City Hall.
If cities are excessively regulated by the state, can we get tax credits?
we've actually asked them that. We were hoping that we would
add
be
that
eligible.
As an amendment.
There's been substantial amendments. Even today, we should see substantial amendments to try to limit this. But all in all, the concept has failed from the start. This has not been implemented in any government entity in the entire country. One of the staff members at the Goldwater Institute testified in committee that he basically had an epiphany one night that this was the way that government should operate, and then he finds people to introduce it and actually run the bill on something that's never been done or tested and implemented in any other place. We've certainly suggested to the legislature, if it's a great idea, do it to the state and see how well that goes before you bring in counties and cities and all other jurisdictions before that. But they would like the one-size-fits-all scenario. Senate Bill 1505 and Senate Bill 1470 are mammoth intrusions, mammoth bills that are egregious intrusions into the way we do day-to-day business in cities and towns. It's a consortium of special interest groups at the legislature. The most vocal proponent of these bills has been the Arizona Rock Products Association, and it would basically script out every way that we go and just do basic interactions as basic functions as a city. It would impact the way that you as a local council are able to pass ordinances and what type of putting handcuffs and constraints on that. It literally, I'll be glad to talk to any of you privately about this, it would take an hour probably on each bill to go through how challenging this is. And this is on the heels of similar organizations passing Senate Bill 1598 last year that we are still in the midst of trying to implement because it was so challenging to do that. And so now to come and just continue to pile on top of cities is very challenging. Both of these bills will be heard in the Senate today, and we're hopeful that some of the efforts and communication that folks are starting to have about the challenging nature of these bills will give the legislature some pause. The East Valley Chamber of Commerce Alliance has come out against Senate Bill 1505, and I think you're starting to see other business groups that are starting to realize that this is more challenging for the way they interact with City Hall if these bills were to pass. But I will say those three bills are probably some of the most challenging of the entire legislature because people love the concept of regulatory reform and they don't actually understand how challenging the provisions of this bill would be to implement.
I think you're being too tough on them, actually, because I think there's no better way to reduce regulation than to create new regulatory bodies to reduce the regulation that you're trying to re-regulate by regulating more than so you can get less. Makes perfect sense to me. Reg. But in essence, that's what they're doing.
That's exactly what
they're doing. They're creating a behemoth, whether through litigation or through empowering state agencies to reduce or simplify. This is one thing in each of these cases where the cure is much worse than the disease. And it amazes me that these crazy ideas are so easily peddled by special interest groups. I don't get it.
Right.
And maybe I never will.
and the bills are so voluminous that folks just hear a 30-second
put a good title, put a great title on it.
Say it's regulatory reform, and people
want and they automatically work. Yeah, we're for, how can that be bad?
Right, exactly. There, so that's one.
We're seeing the ways that is really bad.
Exactly. I'll also mention too one of the another bill that's had a lot of interest at the legislature, and something that city staff has already been working on, has been a self-certification process for building permits. Phoenix instituted a program last year. I think they were the first city in the state to do that, and I know our folks have been looking at that too, and so we're already ahead of the curve if this bill were to be implemented.
Would this be a self-certification? I know one of the well, let me back up. Self-certification would addresses the role of licensed professionals in how it plays out as far as plan reviews and stuff like that. Is that how self-certification sort of works?
Look to Ms. Zalanka to answer that question about the exact nuances of what this bill would cover.
Theoretically, a registered architect or engineer, when they submit plans, they're taking responsibility for the quality of those plans and the completeness of those plans regarding building codes and fire codes primarily. What our staff does is review them. Quite frankly, I've never seen a set of plans in the last 5 years that we didn't have comments on relative to noncompliance with codes. We send them back to the registrants. A self-certification program, and basically the pilot program that Phoenix put in place, a critical piece of it has to be an audit function, that a registrant can come in, submit their plans, say they are in compliance with the regulations. But the key is really when they start getting built. If we've got an inspector go out there and determine that a flaw has been made in a critical system, what happens then? So the program that Phoenix has put together actually has a very critical staff audit program to make sure that the registrants are in fact submitting accurate and complete plans. And basically this would, the specificity of the regulations perhaps would take a little bit of our ability to figure out exactly how it should be implemented away. But we have been looking at, we've been talking to the development community, and quite honestly, it's the responsibility of the registrant. It's their professional liability insurance that's on the line when they go ahead and submit a set of plans. And there are some, the building official in our case, that feels that they should have 100% responsibility when they submit plans. So it's a quality issue. We'll see where it goes. Phoenix's program so far has been successful because they have a limited number of registrants that are coming in, and they've stepped up. Their insurance carriers, their errors and omissions carriers have said, yes, we will back you on this, because if they make a mistake and there's a problem with the building, it goes back to the registrant and their professional liability insurance. And there are some in the development community that, quite frankly, don't want to take that on.
Okay. All right.
No, you're looking at me?
Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, this is something we have to find a balance, because I know there's a real frustration when the city requires plans to be submitted with a stamp from a licensed architect or engineer, and then we bleed it to death. And you know, in the development community, I know there was some frustration. Why you won't let me have a staff member prepare these? You make me go to a licensed engineer. I got to spend all this money, and then you basically rip the plans to shreds. Well, which is right? I mean, either if you're going to be the final, if the city is going to be the final arbiter, which at the end we should be, whether we allow the engineer or the architect's work to stand or not, you know, then let me have my staff, just who's maybe a very talented draftsman, do these, and you guys review the plans. If you're going to make me use a licensed architect, then trust the licensed architect. I don't know what the balance is, and I appreciate you saying that you recognize there is something going on there, but I would be interested to see how that plays out, because I think there is some balance we can.
And we have actually been looking at a pilot program, putting together the audit piece of it to make sure we don't have problems. Quite frankly, our concern is somebody comes in, they self-certify that their plans are accurate, so we give them a building permit, and then as the building's going up, there are major life safety problems.
Yeah.
And who's responsible for
that?
Well,
I think that's a simple question. If you're going to self-certify, that means you've accepted the responsibility.
Right.
That's a great trade-off. But I understand what you're saying is people want to self-certify, but they don't want the they don't want to take the responsibility of that self-certification.
That would be correct in some
that,
cases, sir.
That creates a problem. Yeah. Councilor Finder, you had a comment?
Well, it's a little bit of a stretch, but that model that others are looking at also, you know, we've had discussions here about how we do our future after-building inspections and finding private organizations or the private sector to be able to get to a self-certification, and then instead of having a government entity have to charge and do those services, find an area there. So I think there's a lot of great possibilities, and I'm hoping we kind of, as we work through it, look at both sides, you know, building a building and then maintaining it to those same codes, and it might be a very big cost-saving thing for local governments. So.
And actually, if I could just mention one thing, we already have special inspections where there's particular highly technical areas where we don't have city staff that has that technical expertise. And we have a program where an engineer can come in and they can actually do a special inspection and then certify that the inspection was done and the building is done in compliance with the code. So we already have that piece of it in place for certain things.
But once again, this is the state legislature dictating to the cities how they do this stuff. And my guess is that there's very few people at the state legislature who have any clue how this process really works. But they've got friends who had some problem.
You have some folks who are in some of the trades that that Christine had just referred to who have gone to them and said, hey, wouldn't it be great to mandate this, even though you're starting to see this effort come forward from cities and towns that recognize that under certain circumstances this could be a benefit to the development community and to city staff from a workload standpoint. So.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll transition now. Miranda will start talking about some of the public safety bills that are moving through.
Yes, most of these bills have either resurrected from last year because they died, or they are they've added further language from the measures that passed last year. Start with photo safety, the photo radar prohibition. This is a bill that did die on the Senate floor last year, 15-15. It will be heard in the Senate today. The measure would eliminate photo safety statewide, as it would if it was approved by the voters, as this measure would send the question to the November ballot this year. We know through our data and the information that Mesa PD has provided to you in recent council meetings and study sessions that, especially at the intersections, that has proven to be successful in decreasing the amount of intersection crashes. And sending this measure to a statewide ballot is especially concerning in that, you essentially would have voters of Fredonia and Flagstaff telling what the Mesa City Council can and cannot dictate in their own communities and measures that we find that are safe for our members.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
Just a question. Assuming this bill would pass, would it also prohibit the cameras in school zones?
Yes, it's a complete prohibition, including the intersections, the cameras, vans.
All photo radar.
All photo radar.
Correct.
All photo radar. And once again, I had a legislator ask me on some of these specifics, and I said, listen, and ask if the city of Mesa, what our stand would be, and just to make sure that I'm in concert with the council, I said, our litmus test is not on specific issues. It is on what we believe is a very sound principle that cities should be allowed to govern those items that relate to the cities. And that's why we have cities. Cities have different personalities. Mesa may think one thing about photo radar. Gilbert may think totally different. Our position is based more on whether we believe is an infringement on our right of self-determination. And there are certainly issues that are of really statewide impact. And there's a real statewide interest. This is something that, regardless of how I feel about photo radar, I believe cities should have the right to, and the citizens of that city should have the right to decide for themselves whether they want school zone photo radar or not. And unfortunately, you have people who don't like photo radar, and so they want to impose that upon everyone. And I think our city looks at the principle rather than the specific item, and this to me is an infringement upon cities' rights of self-determination, which I think is important.
Absolutely.
The next two bills simply are added measures, added language to the fireworks bill, which doesn't in fireworks bill from last year doesn't impact us too much, just some sign-in permitting language, and then the political sign issue that the state has determined they will regulate how political signs are placed in our communities. 1306 alarm system installations. That is a bill that stakeholders are continuing to work together. The bill, as introduced, would eliminate our ability to regulate alarm system installers. We are monitoring that bill. If the compromise language is amended and accepted, then we should be okay with this particular bill. Scrap metal is a continuing conversation down at the legislature. It's a problem that continues to be an issue in our community as wire thefts and metal thefts continue to increase. I think Mesa had about $3 million in thefts in our community this past year.
I just want to interject, too. We really appreciate the efforts of Michael Pollack. He has really taken it upon himself to highlight this issue personally to legislators this year, and he has been down really working this as one of the to put a face to the issue with all the properties that Pollack Investments has throughout our community. You can imagine how hard hit some of his properties are, and so often it's been hard for the legislators to kind of put a face with the name. And believe it or not, as we've discussed, the scrap metal industry has a pretty powerful lobby down in the legislature. It's a very lucrative business, as you can imagine. So we really appreciate Michael Pollack stepping up and putting some real face to this issue.
Good. Councilman Richens.
They've had some regulations in this regard in the past. What does this one do now? What are we trying this time?
This current measure only applies to HVAC units.
Okay, so this is a good idea. I'm familiar with this one. It only allows licensed HVAC contractors to sell air conditioning parts for scrap.
Correct.
It's funny because concurrently, I worked with an MCC class that kind of came up with a similar idea, and the legislature actually came up with this idea. It was about the same time. I don't think they talked to each other, but it is a good approach, I thought.
We've had to take a very incremental approach, different by the apple each year, because of some legislators who are adamantly against any further regulation of the industry. And fortunately, there's going to be some changes because of term limits and districts that some of the individuals who are most strident defenders of the scrap metal industry will not be back next year. And
they'll be scrapped.
we're hopeful we can see even more meaningful reforms in the future.
The next two measures are gun-related bills. The first, 2729, we believe will be the vehicle for the guns in public venues bill. We saw that bill last year. It was vetoed. There's some changes to the language this year. This measure, instead, you can correct me, would require armed security officers, whether that's an off-duty police officer or armed non-police officer, to secure our public venues, or we'd have to allow guns in our public buildings.
Yeah, it's another onerous mandate of requiring. It sets the burden on us to provide the facilities if we are going to prohibit guns. So in the Arts Center, we would have to have magnetometers, gun lockers, and armed policemen in order to keep out guns from the performances. And as Mr. Vogel and others explained last year, that's a provision that's in a lot of clauses of performers that they deal with, and so that's just one example. But any building that's open to the public that we have would have to go through similar arrangements, whether it's the East Side Service Center or other public facilities like that as defined in this statute. We would have to make those same provisions in order to keep firearms out of that facility.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Then just a question, that would be any building that the city owns?
Mayor, Councilmember Kavanaugh, I will follow up with you on the exact language. As I understand the bill right now, and it is changing almost daily, as I understand it today, it's just to those public facilities that or city-owned facilities that are open to the public. Okay. So if you had a maintenance yard where you have to be a city employee with a city badge, I don't believe that that as it's drafted now, it would apply to those.
But, for example, it would apply to our branch libraries.
Correct.
Mel. Right. Holcomb Stadium, all those things.
Mayor and Councilmember Kavanaugh, yes, that was one of the major components last year that ultimately killed the bill. You had everyone from the operators of University of Phoenix Stadium to U.S. Airways Arena to any of the large venues. If you're trying to move 50, 60,000 people through in a meaningful effort, and you have these restrictions on magnetometers for every, no matter if it's a concert or if we had Mesa High graduation at the Arts Center, that would be subject to that. Anytime it's open to the public, you would have to have these measures in place. So it would be it would definitely be an expensive endeavor for all levels of government to comply with, and of course, no state funding to go along with this mandate.
Boy, that's a new one.
We'd also like to bring to your attention Senate Bill 1474, which would allow guns on college campuses unless a sign is properly placed and gun lockers are installed. Again, an unfunded mandate to the colleges. We bring this to your attention primarily because ASU Polytechnic and the community colleges in our municipal boundaries.
Just briefly as well, and be glad to take any in-depth questions that council may have. But as you've heard, there are four union bills at the legislature that in various ways impact the way public employee unions interact with their employers. Two of the bills so far have passed the Senate. The outlook for the two that have not passed is very questionable right now as to whether they will go. But the two that have passed would stop any automatic payroll deductions from employees who are in employee unions. Every year that employee would have to reaffirm to opt in to a payroll deduction for any union dues.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
Just a question. Doesn't that violate federal law with the National Labor Relations Board?
Mayor, Councilmember Kavanaugh, I know people are looking at that, and that's one of the grounds that I think some of the concern has been raised, but I have not.
I think that's a place where the federal government has occupied the field.
My guess is, Mayor and Councilmember Kavanaugh, if this were to ultimately pass and be signed into law by the governor, that will certainly be a lawsuit that will be challenged, because I think you have different attorneys, obviously, depending on who's paying your bill, saying different things to that very.
Well, we know the Goldwater Institute. Of course, they don't lobby; they're just providing research on this issue. But I suspect that federal lawyers might have different opinion. Thanks.
I think it's fair to say if that any of these bills are enacted, it will be. There will be a very vibrant court discussion about about these bills. The other bill that passed dealt with and members of union representatives on employee who engage in union activities during the workday, representing, so basically the union reps who negotiate with management of government entities. It would not allow that to happen on their regular work schedule. So basically they couldn't be paid in order to carry out their union duties. So those are the two union bills that passed the Senate. And like I said, all four of them are in various questionable about if only one or all four might ultimately reach the governor's desk.
The next three measures we see as positive and good legislation. The first is Senate Bill 1170, which is the motion picture tax credit bill. It's important to us primarily for the purpose of Gateway Studios. This is a bill that comes back every year. Unfortunately, it has not yet passed. It is now out of the Senate and in the House. We do we believe that Gateway Studios is not financially viable without this tax credit. A number of other states offer this tax credit, and until we see that here in Arizona, I think it will continue to impact the development of Gateway Studios in our community.
What do you think of the odds? I'm sorry, thank you, of that one, because one of our own Mesa elected officials kind of killed it last time in the House. Now that he's gone, does this have a chance of passing the House and going to the governor?
Mayor and Vice Mayor, I think one of the good things about the bill this year is it's a totally reworked tax credit. Many people view New Mexico as the national model for how you work with the motion picture industry. There were a lot of concerns raised by Goldwater and others about the way that our previous motion picture tax credit had been structured and what was guaranteed to the motion picture industry. The bill has been completely reworked this year in a more fiscally conservative manner, and so I think the proponents of the bill are hopeful that it can make it all the way through. But
so you say, is this bill modeled after the New Mexico program?
Correct. Sorry, I didn't finish that. Yes, it's.
And last year's was different than the New Mexico.
Correct. The bill, one of the major concerns of the bill in the past was it basically committed upfront monies to the motion picture industry without necessarily being a return on the investment that they make, and so there was, some would argue that it was far more lucrative to just get the credit than to actually fulfill all the obligations you had with the movie.
Okay, so wait a second. It was more lucrative to have produced something and have it fail and you could make money off of it than to have it succeed?
That sounds like a good
plot line for a play.
Yeah.
Obviously, no one in here has seen The Producers, but that's okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
But now they've tightened that up as the new, in line with the New Mexico model, which definitely is more of a reimbursement as things happen model.
So you earn the credit.
You earn the credit.
Okay.
So it's much more fiscally conservative this year, but you do have a lot of legislators that no matter what the credit actually does. There's been such rhetoric around this issue since the bill sunset 2 years ago, since the credit sunset 2 years ago, that some people probably haven't heard the details and they don't want to hear the details. They just made up their mind that they don't like a motion picture tax credit, period.
Senate Bill 1442, we see as a good economic tool, as it would, as the state would provide funding to cities to pay up to, I believe, 80% of necessary infrastructure and improvements to benefit manufacturing facilities, for example, for solar in Mesa or Intel in Chandler. This bill is scheduled for third read this afternoon in the Senate, and we believe we'll get out of the Senate pretty well and over to the House. Do you have any additional
comments? I'll just add to that. This is a bill that's being pushed by Intel because of the hundreds of millions of dollars in infrastructure that Intel is putting into the new fab plant in Chandler, from just water lines to streets and other things. And certainly we know that after our experience with First Solar or any other major facility that would come into a community. So what this bill would do would allow cities to capture a portion of the state construction sales tax. And as you can imagine, on a facility of that size, why I believe it's $3 billion, it's the fab plant, that's a lot of construction sales tax, you'd be able to capture a portion of that and return it into municipal infrastructure to support that facility. So we could get a portion of the state's money that they would otherwise be collecting on and put it into water and sewer and streets if this bill were to pass. There is a minimum threshold. I believe it's 200. It's either 100 million or 200 million capital investment. So this is only intended and designed in Maricopa County and Pima County. Excuse me. It's a $100 million investment. It's 10 million in the rural areas of the state. The threshold's much lower.
So it's a big project.
It's big projects, and so it's intended to be to address just those unique situations where you're bringing in major facilities.
HCR 2024 is a measure introduced by Representative Faris, who represents a portion of Mesa, and is a resolution that would call upon the state to aggressively pursue to be awarded one of the six testing sites for the unmanned aircraft systems under the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act. We view this as a positive thing for Arizona and perhaps even our community with the airports in Mesa. Any additional comments? Okay. Scott had already talked about the ADWR effort to repeal the $6.7 million from the budget last year. This is a Senate bill in which has a number of sponsors on the bill and unanimously passed out of the Senate. Obviously, we are supportive of this measure and hopefully we'll get a similar response from the House. House Bill 2416, we don't like as much. This bill would require municipalities to provide water and wastewater services outside of our municipal boundaries without any regard to the infrastructure necessary to provide these water services. The bill was amended yesterday in the House and now only applies to Pima County. However, we still have significant concerns as if this bill were to be passed this year, what's to prevent it from incorporating Maricopa County into the language?
Mayor and Council, it's the classic case of legislating for a particular instance. It's there's a developer in Pima County who had wanted to purchase water from Tucson Water and who had planned a development or had purchased land with the idea that they would purchase water from the city of Tucson. In the midst of their efforts to get the land ready for development, the city of Tucson changed its water policy to say that it would not provide water outside of its municipal boundaries. So a developer had invested a lot of money in land, had allowed their water certificate to expire.
They got in a letter of assurance that did. Was only 1 year. Mm-hmm. 1 year. They bought land with a 1 year letter of assurance, and when that letter expired, Tucson said they weren't going to renew it. And so the landowners got mad, and hence this bill.
Exactly.
How you would ever buy a piece of land with only a 1 year letter of assurance of service is beyond me, but.
Exactly. It'll be interesting to see how this bill fares as it moves forward, because there's a lot of concern, even though they limit it to Pima County, obviously you're putting into statute a principle that flies in the face of the way we do water planning and the way we service our communities, because if someone can come in and we're mandated to provide water to them, everything that Ms. Sorensen and the rest of our folks to build out our water portfolio to assure for enough water for build out, the service areas, the pressure and the pipes from how we do that for firefighting, and everything is dependent upon some control that we have over our system and the ability of our local policymakers to decide when and if we go outside of our boundaries to provide water. And so to mandate this because of a particular instance between one developer and one city is very problematic.
Well, I think as Tucson was arguing, it sets up the bizarre potential that you could have one development come in outside your city that you have to provide, and you literally could have people inside your service area that you can't get water to because people outside have taken up your capacity. And you have no idea or control over what developments get planned outside your city boundaries.
Distance requirement within a certain miles that has to be.
That's some of the most problematic aspects of that, Mayor and Mr. Brady. The bill does not actually, it limits dramatically the hookup fees associated with this, and so but you're mandated to provide the service, so the other ratepayers then are going to be footing the bill to pay for the infrastructure, especially if the distance is something that would require a lot of infrastructure. You're never going to get cost recovery from that development in what the limitations the bill sets forth. So the other ratepayers in the city are going to be subsidizing.
Thank heavens our legislature is beyond the influence of special interests, because if that were a problem, I shudder to think what might happen.
You want to know the irony, though. The developer is the City of Dallas Police and Fire Union pension fund. And so they're attacking unions on one aspect and then really helping them out because it's private development on the other. So just somewhat ironic. Another bill that we'll mention that's actually a bill that we have been instrumental in getting introduced and passed through is the Senate Bill 1131, which is the Transportation Project Advancement Notes. You all are very familiar with HPANs, which we just issued, Highway Project Advancement Notes for State Route 24. What Transportation Project Advancement Notes would allow is for all other projects in a regional transportation plan to also be able to accelerate in the same mechanism that highway projects would. So road projects, street projects, transit projects, anything else that's funded in a regional transportation plan, you could also issue notes for to advance the project as well. So we think it's good public policy after the experience we just had with State Route 24 and the over $100 million we saved taxpayers. If there's other opportunities where we need to put in infrastructure, but it's later out in the plan, this is a mechanism that we could use to accelerate that.
I'd like to thank you for saving the one good bill going through the legislature for last.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, we have.
Oh, wait, there's more.
There's more.
Oh, yeah. Wait, sorry.
So I take it back.
That was a teaser.
Yeah, I was hoping to kind of like early applause, maybe shutting this down.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
We'll be quick on this as well. Just one thing to bring to your attention, especially as we're in the midst of budget season, is HB 2264. As you know, last year the legislature in the last minute switched the traditional 50-50 split on employee and employer contributions to the state retirement system. Well, the state was sued. They're going to lose, and so they're being proactive in reverting back to the 50-50 historical split between employee contributions and employer contributions in the state retirement system. So this bill will make it all the way through, or it'll be wrapped up into the budget, but it will go back to the 50-50 split. So that's just something that we'll have to take into consideration and Candace certainly.
How does that? What did it went to? What, 53-47 or
correct, 40, Mayor?
Yeah.
Right. So, but Mayor and Council, this happened late in the session. Mm-hmm. Governor office, I think, did it late in the session. So we hadn't anticipated as part of the budget adjustment. So actually, from forecasting perspective,
it had no impact.
It really has no impact because we weren't anticipating it. We didn't make that adjustment, and by the time anticipating maybe it would adjusting to the law or the bill that was passed. And then knowing there was this lawsuit, we just kind of held back.
So we never in our actual budget
we'll
went
be
to
fine.
The 53-47.
Yeah,
we stayed at 50-50. So it's,
well, at least in budgetary, yeah, we allocated
from a cash flow standpoint.
Now,
but from
what's interesting is the provision that, and this is where it gets maybe a little more, just logistically, it may require us to reimburse those employees.
But once again, that's why I say from a cash flow standpoint.
No,
from
but
a
it's
budget
just going
standpoint,
back
that money should still
cutting checks for
yeah.
those dollars and stuff and netting that out. That's where the cost will come, but it'll be something we'll have
well,
to
well, once again, as compared to budget, that's not really a
no,
cost.
No, you're right.
Since we had budgeted,
right.
You know, if you budgeted $50 out of the $100 coming from the city, and then you ended up only taking $47
yeah.
out, we had still budgeted that, oh. and it's that $3 difference.
On that
is
gross
still sitting
fine,
there.
It's just going to be the hassle of
yeah.
trying to figure out.
Yeah, it'll be an administrative hassle.
But the employees are owed it. That was, it shouldn't have been done, and so we'll figure out a way to get it back.
Okay. It doesn't have any net impact on our budget or, well, this is not money we have to go find. Okay.
Another bill, House Bill 2570 by Representative Justin Olson of Mesa, initially the concept started out as another Goldwater bill, which would have required a three-read process before legislation could be passed by a local government.
Would you explain to us real quickly what, I mean, you guys do
absolutely
first,
that's,
second,
that's,
three reads.
Exactly.
What is a three-read process?
Three-read, basically, under the legislative process, a bill has to be read three times before final.
Read by whom? Remember, nobody in here goes down to the legislature.
Exactly. Maybe a better way to say it is that the bill has to be heard before the legislature three times.
Has to be formally introduced before the legislature three times.
Yes, before it's voted on. The third The third reading, the third introduction of the bill is what we commonly refer to as the final vote of the chamber. It's called
and there the third are there are there are as far as the rules, there are time differences. You can't like read it three times right in the same minute.
Well, you can.
You could. Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. You could, but generally there's a time differential.
Their policy says that. Now, if they decide they really want something, the legislature decides they really want something now, they can just ignore
it. And the idea behind that is that somebody can't show up and then all of a sudden say, ooh, I got a new bill. You read it once, you introduce it once, vote on it, it's done, and then before anyone knows what's happened, you have a bill that's law.
Exactly.
That's the concept behind it. Yeah.
The transparency aspect of the concept is that you would have multiple introductions of the bill so the public understand and the legislature
they know it exists
and what's voting on it.
Vice Mayor,
I just wondered how much it actually impacts us because we read it three times anyway. We had a study session today, which we reviewed the agenda. We're going to have another one on Monday, and then we're going to read that in and vote on it. So that's three times.
We're different because when we do an ordinance, we have to then wait. We have to have a formal introduction, then we have a formal action.
Well, but as Mayor, said, let me tell you, some cities don't do that. Yeah, let me tell you where it is today, though, because we did work with Representative Olson. We appreciate him listening to us, and we explained to him what our city charter actually says, and which is for ordinances an initial reading and then a vote that has to be separated by at least 6 days in between. He likes the way we do it, basically. He understands.
Well, let's put it in our parlance. We don't have an initial reading. We have an introduction of ordinance. Our charter doesn't call it a reading. It calls it an introduction of ordinance before you can take final action. And there has to be at least 6 days between those two.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, Mayor.
If you put it in a legislative reading, there would be a first read and a second read.
Correct.
And those would have to be separated by
what?
There would have to be at least two reads separated by 6 days, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And Mayor, what the problem they're trying to solve, which has some credibility, that in some communities, not in Mesa, but in some communities, you could vote.
Especially some cities that might be larger than Mesa in Maricopa County?
Yes, okay. But that's not even necessarily their
There are other communities. Okay.
Yeah, there are other communities that you can post an ordinance with the minimum 24 hours notice, and then you can vote on make amendments during that council meeting.
Really?
And vote it out. So it doesn't have the requirements of final form like we have, where a bill has to have been in its final form or the process starts over again for introduction and adoption. Strangely enough, most communities in the state operate under that fashion. Now, that being said, a lot of them have already adopted their own policies internally that aren't in their city charters. Most of the general law cities, the non-charter cities, only require a single vote on a bill and not an introduction and then adoption. So
this would change. This would change the general law.
It would have a substantial impact on the general law, and the language is still being worked on as a compromise, but it would somewhat mirror what we do in a way that would require not even officially an introduction and an adoption, but what it would require is public notice of at least a week of when you're going to take action on an ordinance. That's the concept that's being discussed right now, so that you couldn't in 24 hours post an ordinance and vote on that, so that the public has time to respond, has time to understand, because when you do 24 hours, sometimes, especially in rural communities that, you know, here we have media covering us, we have Twitter, we have, you know, things that really get our folks engaged, but in rural communities that don't have the same media transparency as we do in Maricopa, it can sometimes be problematic, I think, for the citizens to know what exactly their council may be voting on. So that's the concept behind it. It started out as a very, very onerous, bad bill from Goldwater, that an apples to oranges comparison, where you're trying to take a legislative process where they meet daily, and many times the three introductions of the bill happen on three consistent days, and apply that to a city council process where we formally meet twice a month And in some communities, they meet monthly, as we've found out in some of the rural parts of the state, and try to impose a state process onto a city council process that just doesn't make sense. And so we appreciate Representative Olson, after he understood the nuances of what we do and the transparency that we do, he's been willing to work with us to find something that's not onerous on what most cities do, while providing at least some transparency for the public to know what their council is going to be voting on before, a few days before, more than the minimum 24-hour requirement. So
I'm still sitting here trying to figure out how the three reads has helped the legislature. How the three reads have actually helped the legislature with their.
It helps them study the issue very thoroughly.
You've had numerous examples.
All day today.
The thorough, thoughtful process.
Of how those have helped. Have you not been listening?
So I've saved one of my favorite ones for last, to the vice mayor's point earlier. Representative Ugenti, Michelle Ugenti of Scottsdale, has introduced House Bill 2826, also a Goldwater-inspired bill, that would mandate that all elections must happen on the fall cycle of even years. There are no exceptions to that, and this would apply to both state and to cities. So, for example, Proposition 100, the temporary 1 cent sales tax, would not have been allowed to be voted on in the May cycle, which is how the governor set it up in order to get the revenue to start by the beginning of the fiscal year that the state desperately needed. At the city level, any special election like Waveyard, like Gaylord, like the Cubs, even though the timing worked out for the Cubs that we were able to have it on fall of an even year, if any of those needed to be voted on by our voters as mandated by our city charter, it's the possibility that we would have to wait up to 2 years to submit that question to the voters. And wherein lies our biggest concern about this bill, because no developer is going to stay in limbo. The Chicago Cubs would not have stayed in limbo for 2 years, wondering.
They wouldn't have stayed in Mesa either.
Correct. If that would have been the gift to Naples.
The other thing is, when you have like zoning referendum or any referendum.
Exactly.
On a council action.
You could have groups.
You'd have to wait clear till the next.
Absolutely.
Now you wait till the next regularly scheduled, and that is March, May, August, November, odd years. There's several allowable
days. Or special elections. The council can obviously call a special election on any one of those days, Mayor.
Yeah. And so right now the options are March, May of any year?
For special elections.
Yeah, March, May, August, November. November. So you have four chances every year, dates upon which you can have it. And then at the state, if you call a special election, well, I guess.
No, they have to be on those dates.
For cities.
March, May, yes.
Right.
The cities willingly, back in the 90s, worked with the legislature on going to the four-date system to bring some order to the process, so that you didn't have Mesa voting on one Tuesday in March and then Scottsdale on another Tuesday in March. So we worked with the legislature, but now you continue to see the idea that you suppress it so much. Maricopa County Elections, which does more elections than anyone in the state, has come out against this. Karen Osborne, other people say it is just too much to put all of this into one cycle, and that doesn't even go into account the specifics of our situation, for example, with special elections. So there is a lot of opposition to this bill, and frankly, what they're trying to do is influence the City of Phoenix election cycle. The City of
influence.
Phoenix.
Mandate.
Yeah.
And City of Tucson. Also.
Well, they're trying to influence, in many regards, the outcome, because they think if outcomes could be different in city elections if they're held in the fall.
Because both Tucson and Phoenix are on odd year cycles.
Correct. And in fact, you had a mayoral candidate for the City of Phoenix come down and testify to committee, one that obviously was not successful, in saying that he believed that that he would have won, basically, had this been on the fall cycle of an even year. So to try to engineer the politics into the way we do our elections has some definite unintended consequences to this. Yeah.
Well, the intended consequences, but they are unintended, because I'm sure that they didn't even consider referendum and other types of special elections that works, for example, City of Mesa, where we actually put in the hands of our voters most major decisions as it relates to 613 issues and stuff like that. And what it does is it completely messes up that balance that we have. I mean, the trade-off is the citizens can come in and enforce a referendum on a council action, but you know you're going to have some resolution in a timely manner, because you have four times a year where you can take that to the voters. And even in that case, that's enough to kill a proposal or kill a development or kill whatever action you have. I mean, even knowing you can do it four times during the year, only having it every 2 years completely distorts that balance. And it will kill, I believe, a lot of economic development opportunities, because this is a, you know, the Cubs are a great example. Certainty is what people need, and they cannot wait a year or 2 years to have that. We got lucky in the sense that when the Cubs came up, it just happened to fall on that cycle. Mm-hmm. But if that had, let's say that had come up, well, Gaylord would have never happened. I mean, people say, well, it's not going to happen now, but at least there's a chance. It's not going to happen for economic reasons, which I can accept. It's hard to accept the fact that by a quirk in state law, it would kill that deal, because nobody who's making investments is going to wait up to a year even. 2 years, absolutely not. It's very difficult to keep them waiting months. So it's unfortunate that this unintended consequence, in order to force some intended consequences, is will have a huge impact on Arizona.
Absolutely.
You know, Mayor, I think one of the things that the fallacy is, well, because of the big election, a lot of the municipal issues get pushed to the back pages or pages. And voter fatigue, you see a lot of people drop off as they're going down the ballot, and they just kind of, they don't pay attention to stuff on the back end. And so it kind of defeats the whole idea that it's supposed to get more people interested. A lot of times, the voter fatigue, they don't ever even get to that back page sometimes.
That's not the real idea behind it.
Well, I know, but that's yeah. Something that's
a consequence. Less people to be involved.
So we will continue to vigorously oppose that bill for handcuffing this council to be able to actually fulfill the wish of our voters, which was to be able to weigh in on more projects that that come across come through the city, and it would have a dampening effect on some development projects in the city.
Councilman Richens.
Does it do anything to address the disenfranchised voters in municipal elections that are registered independents that can't vote in primaries because they don't get a ballot unless they request it, even if they're on the permanent early ballot list?
No. Mayor, council member, no. The last thing I wanted to mention as well, based on our conversation the other day, and I will, in council member Glover's subcommittee, we'll be discussing this more, but staff's going to keep our eyes open for any opportunities to amend any election bills that are moving through to address the signature requirement issue for the district system. The bill a couple of years ago, Scottsdale was trying to fix, and it's just two different sections of state statute that deal with at-large cities and district cities. And so Scottsdale was fixing their problem. I doubt anyone really even realized that the at-large or the district system was still a problem. So if there's a way that we can amend any bills that are moving through to fix the signature issue for district cities, then we'll attempt to do that as well, based on the conversations from council.
Yeah, that would be great, because I don't know that would, it doesn't seem like that would be a huge issue. So that's something that I'd appreciate if you could.
And with that, Mayor, council, we'll be glad to take any questions you may have. Sorry for an exhaustive list, but we wanted to wait until they passed the introduction time frame, because this would have been a 40-page PowerPoint of all the bad bills had we not waited till they passed the initial deadline that bills are first heard in committee. But we wanted to give you an unfortunate taste of some of the things happening down in the legislature.
We're glad that there's so few issues that the state has to deal with that they need to manage cities too, because it's just heartwarming to find out that there are so few problems at the state level that they have to bide their time managing cities. Councilmember Finter.
Just a quick question. Yeah. Any opportunities or anything about separation of downtown schools to nightclubs and any? I thought there was a time when we were going to try and see if there was something that could be done there at a state level.
Mayor and Councilmember Finter, yes. The last year, the entertainment district concept was put into statute, but there were some oversights in the drafting as it dealt with private schools and charter schools. There is a fix going through on every year. The Department of Liquor has a liquor omnibus bill where they come up with technical fixes that they have to address situations. The fix that the cities had requested for the entertainment district statute is included in that liquor omnibus, which usually garners broad support at the legislature. So we expect that fix to happen and can help address some of those issues. And I know that we have staff who have talked to you and have talked to council about the entertainment district, and this should really help make sure we have everything that in a road for formation of such a district.
Okay. All righty. Any other questions? Thank you. Hear reports on meetings or conferences attended. Mr. Brady. Oh, hold it. Mr. Richens. Oh, yeah. Talk about yesterday.
Yeah, yesterday at the Mesa Arts Center, we hosted a Buy Local to Build the Arizona event. We had probably 100 or so folks from across the valley come and attend to talk about procuring items from businesses within our region. And I think it was a real success. It was, had a few legislators attend and purchasing folks. I don't know that I saw any of our purchasing folks attend it. It would have been great to have them there, but maybe we can get that information over to them. Thanks.
Thank you. Anything else? Mr. Brady.
Mr. Ryder, are we going to be ready here in a minute? Okay. So quickly, we have our first spring training game is Sunday, March 4th. However, we will also have our official kickoff with the council next Monday on March 5th. So you should have that information. There will also be an opportunity. They're going to be recognizing Robert Britton and his contributions to spring training, certainly as it relates to the Chicago Cubs. So you should be getting some information today if you haven't already got it about the schedule for that. I invite you to be part of that. And Mr. Britton's family will be also included in that. Also want to remind the council that there will be a downtown summit Tuesday, March 6th, beginning at 7:30 a.m. So I think we've got several, not businesses, developers, they're interested, will be here for that. So I encourage you to do that. What we'd like to show you now is a little kind of a video. A summary of some shots we took during the CNN event. So can we start that? Just want to thank the staff for putting that together and thank the council for your cameo appearances during the video broadcast. So just want to share that with you. We'll be making that available online. We're going to be sending it to CNN as our thank you to them for the partnership, and we'll have it available on Channel 11 also. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Brady. And once again, thanks to staff and thanks to everyone. What a great event. Ms. Crocker, any additional requests to speak from the public?
No.
Okay, we'll entertain a motion to enter an executive session. And from Councilmember Fender, a second Councilmember Glover. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We're now going into executive session. Thank you.